This is a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, good afternoon and welcome to Enterprise Explores, the show where we help you navigate the ever-changing universe of business from the headlines to the bottom line. Today, we're exploring four travel trends driving consumers in 2024, as highlighted by the Amex Travel 2024 Global Trends Travel Trends Report. And we're going to get a sense for who in Southeast Asia is most well-positioned in each of these trends, where Malaysia stacks in its ability to leverage those trends, and the opportunity that these trends present for the region as a whole. Helping me with this is Hannah Pearson. She is the founder of travel market intelligence firm Per Anderson and Gary Bauman, the director of travel and tourism research firm Check In Asia. So the four trends that the Amex report highlighted that are driving booking decisions, they say, are for the love of the game, planning big, going solo, and on a whim. I think each of those subtitles kind of tells you what it's about, but just in case I need to break it down for you a little further, For the Love of the Game is about sports and trip for sports fans, planning trips around that, around sports events, things like football matches in Europe or over here, Olympics and things like that. We've got Planning Big, which is basically these big, major expedition-style adventures like a trip to the Galapagos or trekking with the gorillas, as Amex uses as an example here. They've got going solo, straightforward travelers taking solo trips around the world and easing their planning and ability to basically not have to cater other people's plans and itineraries. And of course, on a whim, being able to go on a trip, on a whim. And if you have any thoughts on all this, you can WhatsApp us on our U-Mobile number. That's 018-789-8899. Hannah, Gary, welcome to the show. Welcome to the studio.
Hi, Roshan.
Thank you.
Now, first time we're having this combination on air together talking about tourism. And funnily enough, you both co-host a show called the Southeast Asia Travel Show. Not like that influenced this decision whatsoever.
Not at all. Not at all.
And I understand that this is the first time that you're recording together in a room in person, because usually it's remote recording for your shows.
Well, we did start before the pandemic. But during the pandemic, that pushed everything remote. So it's been a long time, Roshan. Yeah.
So before we get into the trends, and is there anything either of you would like to say as a preamble to maybe set some context for the trends ahead of the report itself? Right? Because I think we should also mention that Amex is a bit more of a more affluent demographic in terms of who is using their cards and the data that they're getting. But is there anything else you want to touch on before we jump into the trends?
Well, I would say first and foremost, terrific timing. It's the 1st of April. It's exactly 2 years since Southeast Asia began to reopen after the pandemic. So what's happening in travel and tourism at the moment is we're starting to see some of those trends redeveloping, some old trends reestablishing themselves. And obviously, everybody in the travel industry is looking for the emerging trends, the hot trends, the new trends. So I guess that's perfect for our discussion right now.
Fantastic. Hannah, anything you want to add?
Yeah, I mean, like you say, I think we also have to take this with a little pinch of salt with that. The mindset of who has been answering these surveys. So I was looking and it's US, Australia, Canada, UK, Mexico, and a little bit of Asia. So we've got Japan and India in there, but we're missing some big markets, right? We're missing China. We're not really got the Southeast Asia flavor in there, but it's still important because a lot of these markets are traveling into Southeast Asia.
They're spenders, right?
And exactly.
The US market, the Western markets are spenders. The first trend that they've highlighted here is for the love of the game. Now, the Amex report sees that sports fans are planning trips around athletic events, whether it involves a favorite sport, a favorite team, or an international multi-sport competition. This could be quite timely given all the conversations around the Commonwealth Games recently, or even if we look ahead to Euro 2024 and other sport events that are going to happen over the next few years. So the first thing, I guess, how big of an opportunity do both of you think this presents for regional tourism? And I guess who here in the region is most well positioned to leverage this?
Well, I would say you're absolutely right. 2024 is a big year for sport. It's the Olympic year. It's the Euros year, as you say. I don't think this is particularly a new trend either. I mean, this was happening from sort of mid-2010s onwards, you know, particularly in our country, you know, the massive support for the Premier League, for European football. You do have a lot of Malaysians go overseas to go and see the big football matches. But here in the region, obviously, we haven't had some of those major sporting events. And that's something that I think, you know, you're starting to see. Everybody wants to host these events. going forward. But they are big undertakings. You mentioned the Commonwealth Games. Malaysia's turned that down. Looks like Singapore probably will, probably because it's short notice. But to have those kind of signature events is what's really, really important. And you're looking at the major things, I guess, in the region at the moment, probably F1. Singapore does that really, really well.
Yes, they do. They certainly do. And they time it around a lot of other conferences as well. So there's other things to do while you're there. But yeah, F1 is a great example of that, right? Around the world every year. And when it comes to this side of the world, the only way we're going to get access to that is to go to Singapore. Sepang's no longer a key figure in that. Hannah?
Yeah, I mean, and I think, you know, when you're looking at the region in particular, a country like Indonesia is now starting to incorporate sports tourism within their main strategies. Mm-hmm. So they have this policy of 5 super priority destinations, which are destinations they want to promote outside of Bali.
Okay.
But what they have done is they have launched the MotoGP in Mandalika, which is Lombok, which is one area that they want to promote, mm-hmm. and also looking at Lake Toba, and they're doing a power boating series as well. So they're being quite smart in their use of, okay, right, we want to develop these destinations. What sporting events can we bring to those destinations? And then they're looking at how can we make it more of an event? Like you said, Singapore is very smart. They arrange conferences on the side of F1. For example, in Lake Toba just now, they were having local rowing boat races. So they also incorporating like local culture as well as like these big events, which is quite a smart tactic, I think.
Yeah, and some of these do cross, right? Like For the Love of the Game can cross with Planning Big, for example. Mm. You want to go for F1, maybe you spend a bit more time in Singapore, you go to Marina Bay Sands, you go and catch Hamilton or something like that, or some of the other shows there. I will be going for Hamilton in May, luckily enough. Got a seat there. So see, Singapore's pulling me there. I didn't go for Taylor Swift, unfortunately, but probably should have. But anyway, so it's interesting to see. So you've pointed out Indonesia here, pointed out obviously Singapore when it comes to these kind of big events. F1, they've done very well with that and making it a night race and making it essentially a long weekend party. That's what F1 really does well. Aside these two names, so Indonesia has potential here. Before we talk about Malaysia, where does Thailand stack up in terms of sports, right? Because not something, I mean, I'm not super familiar, but they're not something that they're super well renowned for in terms of tourism attractions.
No, but I think you've hit the nail on the head. Is you mentioned Taylor Swift and you mentioned F1. I think what tourism is becoming now is this, where you tag events and then you have so many different bolt-ons to attract tourists around that time. So as you said, F1, they turn that into a festival. Right? It's almost a 2-week festival with music and conferences, everything like that, to, you know, just throw the whole kitchen sink at it, really. And I think that's what Thailand is trying to do. It's really looking forward to how it can really turn event tourism into something similar. But it's playing catch up, really. Hasn't really done that before, but it's looking at the major sporting events. I mean, there have been talk for many, many years that ASEAN would host the World Cup. You know, there was a bid potentially put in place. Whether that will happen, we don't know. But this is the kind of thing I think that really, really needs. You need something region-wide to kind of innovate and invigorate this kind of sports tourism. But then again, as Hannah said, you know, it's very, very important to pare that down and look at destination-specific. So the power boating in Lake Toba is a great example of how you can create an event. In Langkawi, you know, they have like the cycling race, that kind of thing. You can really generate local interest. Mm. It doesn't have to be on a major global scale to attract people, particularly the cycling race in Langkawi attracts a lot of Malaysians to go and watch.
Actually, MotoGP also is quite big here. Sepang is still quite utilised for that. Hannah?
Yeah, I mean, and I was going to say the other side to sports tourism is people actually taking part in it themselves. Right, which we are seeing more and more. So right now, Vietnam, if you're looking at trail running, and trail running is something I used to do, let's say, pre-kids. I still think of myself as a trail runner, but one day I'll get
once
back to
once a trail runner, never not a trail runner.
Exactly. Yeah, I'll think about that. But Vietnam is really getting a name for itself for trail running. They've got a lot of really interesting trails. And the really interesting thing about that one, again, is that they're off the beaten track. They're in small villages and they're kind of bringing those economic opportunities to those communities as well, and showcasing a side to Vietnam that travelers might not otherwise see. You've got Thailand, who are looking to launch a Muay Thai visa.
That would be interesting.
Right, exactly. So there's this other side of trying to get people to come to Southeast Asia to participate in sports tourism as well as just, you know, going to attend like these large scale events.
Actually, this jogs my memory a little bit, and this was a long time ago. It was 10 years ago, actually. I went for a run in Cambodia around Angkor Wat, right? There was this annual Angkor Wat run, and it was a big endeavor. The whole family went because we were, back then, a lot of more of us were runners. And we went together. We ran around the track. Some did 5, some did 10. You know, it was a family affair. It was a big thing. And it pulled us to a country that maybe we would never have gone on our own, right? It tapped onto a interest, and that interest was running. And that's also a sport. I forget that sometimes. we're gonna talk about some of the other trends as well. We've got 3 more to cover. But for now, we've got to go into a few messages. Folks, today we're talking about 4 travel trends potentially driving consumer behavior in travel here in 2024. And helping me with this conversation has been Hannah Pearson, founder of tourism market intelligence firm Pear Anderson, and also Gary Bauman, director of travel and tourism research firm Check In Asia. They're also co-hosts of the Southeast Asia Travel Show. I'm Roshan Gunderson. This is Enterprise Explores. Keep it here to BFM 89.9, the business station.
Binge-friendly movies. BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, welcome back to Enterprise Explores, the show where we help you navigate the ever-changing universe of business from the headlines to the bottom line. Today on the show, we're exploring 4 travel trends potentially driving consumers here in 2024, as well as who in Southeast Asia is most well-positioned to leverage these cited trends, where Malaysia stacks there, and the opportunity these present for the region as a whole. Helping me with this conversation is Hannah Pearson, founder of tourism marketing intelligence firm Pear Anderson, as well as Gary Bauman, director of travel and tourism research firm Check In Asia. They're also co-hosts of the Southeast Travel Show. So any chemistry here is not because of me, it's because they talk to each other on a regular basis. So earlier we talked about For the Love of the Game. That was one trend that the Amex report highlighted. I'd like to now jump into trend 2, which is planning big, right? Which they describe as major expedition style adventures, like a trip to the Galapagos Islands or trekking with the gorillas, which they say adds a transformative experience, quote unquote, that travelers are looking for. How big of an opportunity is this for the region overall?
I mean, if I put my adventure travel hat on, now I play another role to co-host of Southeast Asia Travel Show and everything else, in that I am the Adventure Travel Trade Association's APAC Regional Director. So we talk a lot about adventure. And in our own research, we see, the second highest demand trip are to remote destinations and trails. The 9th biggest trend is longer duration. So there really is this thirst for people to get off the beaten track and to challenge themselves. Like you say, it's that form of transformation in terms of meeting a new challenge, whether that's physical, whether that's mental, whatever that is. And so when you look for the region, there's definitely an opportunity here. And I think the opportunity, if we talk in terms of the destination itself, is that they get a better type of tourism. Mm. And what I mean by that is that these kind of travelers tend to spend more. They tend to travel longer. Generally, they're more concerned around sustainability, so they have a lower carbon footprint. So they're the kind of travelers that a destination should be focusing on rather than going after that mass tourism, cruise tourist kind of market.
So these are high value targets in a way.
Yeah.
Gary, anything to add there?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. In terms of high value, you know, that's high yield is the buzzword in tourism at the moment. I think, as Hannah said, you know, that you want travelers that respect their local communities as well and get involved in and where you can bring local communities into travel, which adventure travel you actually can. I think that's something that we're going to see a lot more of in this region. It's a beautiful region. There's a lot of untapped, you know, look at countries like Laos, for example, pretty untapped, but huge adventure opportunities. There are some entrepreneurs there that are actually starting to really develop the opportunities there. And I think one of the interesting things, we actually spoke to one on the podcast last week, and there is a real growth of Asian travelers really getting involved in adventure travel. You know, it used to be perceived as a European or a Western or North American pursuit, but it's now international, it's global. And that's great for the region. We'll see a lot more development once it actually comes from within the region itself.
And where does Malaysia stack up when it comes to being able to tap into this trend?
I mean, I think it has so much potential, particularly if you're looking at East Malaysia, you're looking at Sabah, you're looking at Sarawak. You know, you can really go on expeditions like this, can't you? You can go and go trek the pinnacles in Sarawak, go see Gunung Mulu, climb Mount Kinabalu. So we really have that potential here for these kind of transformative expedition-style trips, like you're saying. And I think Sabah and Sarawak are starting to put their mark on the map. For example, I was at ITB Berlin, which is the biggest travel show in the world in Germany a few weeks ago. And Sarawak had its own pavilion. Mm. It was actually separate from Tourism Malaysia. it had its own pavilion that was just like, here we are, come find out about us. And, you know, they're quite serious, I think, about really focusing on this type of travel to give themselves a competitive advantage in the region.
So East Malaysia is a great spot for us there. Gary, anything to add?
In Malaysia?
For Malaysia.
No, I think that the major opportunities would be there. Mm-hmm. That's where you'd be looking at. But, you know, it's going to get competitive. You know, all countries in the region have worked out now that tourism is changing. Younger people's aspirations have changed the way we travel. You know, as you were saying off air, you know, this scarring from the pandemic is still really impacts the way we want to travel in future. Whether we actually have the ability to or whether we're actually going to live these dreams out is a different thing. But I think everybody understands now that tourism is going to change. Thailand is a good example. They're now trying to push travelers into secondary and third tier destinations, you know, to disperse people into areas of the country that they just haven't seen before. There's a great opportunity to explore parts of Thailand that we've never seen. The same will happen in Malaysia. The same is going to happen in all countries. There's a domino effect. You'll see that around the region. And I think Malaysia will do that. But as Hannah said, you know, East Malaysia really has huge opportunities. And I think they're really going to grasp those.
Hannah, at the conference you were at, Sarawak had its own pavilion. You know, how are we, I guess the ability to execute upon all these adventures is also about how do we make this easy for travellers to put together, correct? Not everyone's going to sit down and do the itinerary themselves. So if you can package it together and sell it to them in a way that is more accessible, that could be a way to tap into natural resources in the way of, like, from a tourism perspective. Are we seeing packages being built out around this?
Yeah, definitely. I would say that, you know, there have always been these kind of tour operators focusing on that. And I think the challenge has always been for, you know, for Southeast Asia to then how do you reach the markets who are wanting that. And especially if we're talking about longer travels, those longer travels do tend to be Europeans. They tend to be North American travelers.
During the summer or the winter, get out of those their respective countries.
Right, exactly. Or maybe even to escape the winter. Mm-hmm. So the challenge is how do you connect the two sides together, right? So that the travel trade across the other side of the world know about, you know, a country like Sarawak. And coming to these exhibitions is one way of doing that. So I think we are stepping in the right direction, but there's always more that can be done.
I wonder if there is a, you know, we should be looking at adventure tourism as a region, right? Because Southeast Asia has a lot to offer. Each country has something to do. I guess there's no real operating, like, top-down where the regions are talking to each other in terms of how we can package it together. Is there anything like that?
ASEAN?
At surface level, there is. I think it's just so competitive, Roshan. I think one thing we learned from the pandemic is that, you know, there was very little integration in terms of the way the region reopened.
Yeah.
And as we've seen in the last 2 years, competition between destinations is really, really fierce. But I would say the one thing that I think that will actually facilitate this in future is that there's still an infrastructure gap. You know, it's still quite difficult to travel to some of the places. And you look, I referenced Laos earlier, you know, Laos now has this train that runs through a large part of the country, which is opening up access to areas that probably were more difficult to get to before. And I think, you know, in Sarawak and Sabah, there needs to be that growth of infrastructure, particularly transport, to open up some of these regions.
Now, it occurs to me that I actually didn't ask about where Malaysia stacks up and leveraging sports in our earlier trend. So let's track back a little bit now that we're settled with planning big. So again, sports, we cited things like how Singapore uses F1. In Indonesia, we're seeing things like, what was it? Was it rowing, Hannah? Power boating in particular regions of Indonesia. More vertical, more niche sports focused on areas that kind of complement the existing, not infrastructure, but the existing allure of a destination. When it comes to sports, where does Malaysia stack up in its ability to leverage it to drive tourism?
Well, I mean, one of the benefits is it has one of the biggest stadiums, I think, in Southeast Asia. Mm. And so you have the Legends game coming up, Liverpool and Manchester United,
yes,
which will that's going to gain great interest. Whether most of that interest is going to be within Malaysia, because I think there'll be huge interest from within Malaysia for mm-hmm. that. But, you know, you may get some visitors coming from around the region for that game. I think that's a huge kind of marker for the way that you can use such an important stadium. But football, this country is football mad. So there are a lot of opportunities there. We do get games during the off season. The Premier League clubs, the European clubs sometimes come and play here. But I think a lot of this is in development. I think over the next decade, we're going to see this whole region change in terms of the way it looks at participative sports and event sports as well. So there's room for growth. I think there are opportunities we haven't seen yet and that they will probably emerge.
Football madness is actually something that can really, really drive. I remember even for clubs I wasn't a fan of. So I'm an Arsenal fan. And when Arsenal came down, again, I think 10 plus years ago, I was there, right? And if you're the only stop in the region, then maybe you can tap in on other, on the Thai tourists and Singapore tourists who enjoy football as well to come down for that. But even, if United came down, it's still a Premier League club that's in town. You want to kind of see them play some football.
Or even Liverpool, Roshan, who could be Premier League champions this year.
let's not talk about it. I'll leave that for just for kicks to talk about later today. But hey, it's a competitive title race this year. Let's hope Arsenal doesn't bottle it. all right. So, Hannah, anything to add about sports?
Not really. Just as Gary said, I think there's a lot of potential and let's see how things play out.
Now, going solo is the third trend that Amex highlights in their report. And just as it sounds, this is where travelers take trips alone, embracing the ease of planning and the ability to tailor their itineraries to fit what they want. And a lot of times when you're planning in a group, you have to find the common denominator, right? Which means compromising on certain things. Now, how big of an opportunity is this concept of going solo as a tourism driver for Southeast Asia?
I'm huge. I would say this is probably the most relevant one of the four that we're talking about today. I think we started to see that during the pandemic, that people were actually getting out. There is a greater willingness now to travel solo. There used to be a bit of a stigma around it. But we've seen, if you look at all the social surveys, people are delaying marriage, people are delaying having children. People want to have those experiences. You were talking earlier about the experiential nature of travel, particularly at a younger age mm-hmm. or even at a senior age. I think there's huge potential here. But it's not easy. This is one of the things, if you're a single traveler, do you do that as an independent traveler? Do you do that with a single group travel? This is where the kind of gets a bit challenging, the actual way that you will travel. But in terms of the demand, I think it will be huge.
Hannah?
Yeah, I think Gary's right. I think the infrastructure, there's a bit of a mismatch, essentially, then, because the tourism industry isn't really geared towards solo travel. You have then your single room supplements, and everything is a lot more expensive than if you're traveling as a pair. But the growth is really there. And I think an interesting segment, and this perhaps has not necessarily hit Asia yet, I haven't seen studies around it, but certainly in Western countries, is this growth of 50 plus women solo travel. So it's the kind of women who have kids have left already and they say, okay, well, I've got some more time, I've got some more money. My husband doesn't really want to travel with me. That's cool. I'm going to go traveling anyway. I'm going to go see what I want to see. Mm. And there are lots of studies that say that this kind of segment, these women aged 50 plus, they have over $15 trillion worth of purchasing power. And that was last year. And they're actually experiencing the largest population growth. Mm. So this is actually going to be, a big segment. Sometimes when we think about solo travel, we tend to think about backpackers and young people going out. But actually, there's this
it's getting more affluent segment. Right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, you're seeing solo packages being catered for them. You're seeing more affluent experiences, hotels, spas, all these different things that cater to a particular demographic. As you were mentioning earlier, right, the yield component. So I think typically the assumption would be with going solo, it's a high volume but lower yield tourism business, where else the adventure stuff is where the margin can really come in. Do you see space as it gets more affluent for going solo to start bringing some of that margin into the business?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and even it can be the adventure segment too. You know, increasingly a lot of adventure companies are launching these kind of itineraries aimed at single women. And like Gary said, it might be that they're traveling as a group, but they're booking on as a solo person as well. Right? So there's that kind of social element. But it is definitely becoming a more lucrative segment, I think.
And I think with the hotel sector, I mean, there's often that perception as a single traveler, you know, you go and you sit in your room and then what do you do? Like, you know, you don't want to go to the bar, you don't want to go to the restaurant on your own. But I think hotels are moving now towards making their lobby spaces more social, you know, where people actually can meet rather than just, you know, the only options are the spa or the restaurant or the bar. So, you know, that's going to open up the ability for people to actually feel more comfortable when they actually arrive in a hotel or a destination.
That is interesting. And when we talk about this, about going solo. I think, you know, if we're based this on Hollywood movies, it's always going to Thailand, for example, right? And, you know, you start at Bangkok, maybe you go to Phuket after that, or going around Indonesia, where much bigger countries for you to kind of travel around, tap into that adventure side of things. Or maybe you go to Singapore first and use that as your base of operations to travel elsewhere. Where does Malaysia stack up when it comes to being able to tap into solo travelers? Whether adventure or otherwise.
I think one of the advantages that it's got going for it is that it's English speaking. And I think particularly when you're looking at solo travel destinations and you're trying to choose it, you're going to choose it on safety. Mm. You're going to choose it on how, you know, how easy is it for me to be able to travel around. And the fact that it is English speaking, pretty safe destination, really, all things considered. And it puts it a little bit higher up the ranking than some other destinations where you think, oh, are they going to speak English? Am I going to be able to be understood? What happens if I get lost and I'm by myself? All of those kind of considerations.
Yeah, Gary?
And I think also it has destinations like Penang and Malacca, which aren't really overwhelming. You know, they're not huge mega cities. You know, you can actually go and explore those on your own and feel relatively comfortable. There's going to be people around you. You don't have to explore parts of a city that you're on. You're going to get lost or that kind of thing. I think that is quite an introductory way to travel as a single traveler. Feeling comfortable is very important.
And I guess that point of it not being too big is really important as well, right? Otherwise, it can be quite intimidating. And then Penang, if you go to Penang, you will, you know, have your fair share of culture, but, you know, a latte around the corner as well, right?
Right.
So you've got Georgetown is a perfect place for you to feel like you're immersing yourself in culture, but at the same time, it is largely English speaking. You're not going to be afraid of not being able to find someone who can communicate, even if it's not the person you are with in front of you. Someone around should be able to communicate in English to kind of get you around. So some interesting things here going solo. We've got one more trend to get into, which is could be quite interesting, on a whim. But before that, a few messages. Folks, I've been speaking with Hannah Pearson and Gary Bauman. Hannah is the founder of tourism market intelligence firm Per Anderson, and Gary Bauman is the director of travel and tourism research firm Check In Asia. They're also co-hosts of the Southeast Asia Travel Show. I'm Roshan Kanasan. This is Enterprise Explores. We'll be back in just a bit. So keep it here to BFM 89.9, the business station.
Better Finance Management. BFM 89.9.
BFM 89.9, welcome back to Enterprise Explores, the show where we help you navigate the ever-changing universe of business from the headlines to the bottom line. And today we're exploring four travel trends that could drive consumer behavior in 2024, as well as who in Southeast Asia is most well-positioned to leverage these trends. And helping me with this is Hannah Pearson. She's the founder of tourism market intelligence firm Per Anderson, as well as Gary Bauman, director of travel and tourism research firm Check In Asia. They're also co-hosts of the Southeast Asia Travel Show. Gary, Hannah, we've got one more trend as we start descending the flight, as we make our way towards port. The last trend that Amex highlights is on a whim, which they describe as, in quotes, with so much of life being structured and scheduled these days, people are seeking flexibility in their travel plans and leaving room for spontaneity. So I guess between being locked in because of Zoom calls and all these other things, and also because before this, travel was largely very structured, right? You'd have to plan it. You'd have to make sure that you hit your times and your hotel room and your flights and all of that. But you are starting to see more, you know, flexible options with flights and travel plans as well, which is probably catering to this. How do you both see this impacting the way Southeast Asian countries are gearing up for travel and tourism?
Well, I think, you know, regionally, we are going to see more and more of this kind of last minute type travel, which is, there's two things, right? Is one, it's having that flexibility to book a travel more last minute. And then when you're on your trip, it's having the flexibility to do what you want. And I think we are seeing this removal of barriers when it comes to being able to book a trip last minute. So gradually we're getting more and more flights being added back in. The flight prices have come down a little bit, although are still expensive. We are seeing that removal of visas. So that makes markets like China and India also able to kind of act on the whim to come to Southeast Asia, which is quite interesting. So there's kind of that side of things going on at the moment.
Gary, anything to add to that?
Yeah, I would agree with what Hannah said. I think there are two elements that are quite important. One, in most of Asia Pacific, actually, travel tends to be quite public holiday based. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's not really whim. That you do plan in advance, and that's kind of the culture of travel. And, you know, that isn't really going to change too much. But I think the other thing that adds to that, what Hannah said, is, you know, we have this growth of these experiences platforms that, you know, actually now enable you to actually not just book your flight, not just book your hotel, not just book your transport, but actually plan something else when you arrive. And that makes the planning shorter, essentially, because you can do it on a whim. Whereas before, you were probably a bit reticent about, well, if I arrive, what can I do? Now you have those options. So I think if people are, you know, find themselves in between jobs or something like that, you know, that may happen. Booking windows generally are a lot shorter than they used to be anyway. But we've had 2 years of real disruption in the industry in terms of the numbers of flights that were available. As Hannah said, that the flight prices in this region have been quite high. The cost of travel is generally a lot higher than it was, even though visa fees are sometimes being removed. But I think Hannah made a good point in terms of China. I think that's a really interesting one to watch, because that is a kind of destination that people just think, well, maybe we would like to go and experience it and haven't done before. But whether you do that as planning or whether you do that on a whim, let's wait and see.
Yeah, so I'm wondering, like, based on these four trends, the on a whim one seems to be the least, not uplifting, but the least prominent one, because planning, given flight prices and capacity still coming on online, your ability to go on a whim would really depend on your ability to eat those prices, right? Like if you wanted to go for a weekend to Langkawi, you still have to pay for the flight ticket unless you're going to drive 7 hours then get a ferry across.
Yeah, and I think it's probably a little bit more applicable to domestic travel. At the moment, it's quite difficult because currencies are quite weak, and that has a big impact on your planning of your trip. You know, you can't just drop what you're doing and go to a country where it's going to be higher price. So you do have to plan in terms of your currency value at the moment. It has quite an important impact.
Yeah, don't remind me, Gary. Oh, man, the Singapore trip to see Hamilton really is painful in a lot of ways, but it'll be worth it. So actually, this component of local tourism could be an interesting one, right? Where maybe on a whim is more domestically focused as opposed to a lot of international focus, which we've been giving a lot of focus on throughout the show. But I guess domestic tourism isn't a big driver of tourism, generally speaking, right? It's getting foreign receipts in. Is that right?
I think governments should see domestic tourism as the backbone of the tourism industry. Mm-hmm. And certainly they had to during the pandemic because they had no other choice. And then they started to focus on it. And now the borders are open and it's much more interesting to focus on the international tourists again. But you're right. I think domestic tourists should be a large proportion of the industry, but they just travel quite differently, right? You know, if they're traveling somewhere, they might stay with a family and friend instead. Mm-hmm. But what that doesn't mean is they might still book for an attraction, or they might still book on a tour, perhaps when they're there. So it's trying to reach out to them, and it's also getting these domestic tourism players who perhaps might not be so digitally savvy to be able to tap into these kind of online travel agents where you can book last minute, and to connect all of those dots, I think, is a bit challenging.
That's really important, right? Because your ability to go on a whim really depends on your accessibility. And as you were talking about earlier, Gary, things like Klook and all these different services, even Airbnb experiences, has made it easy for you to look at a catalogue of experiences. So if, let's say, it's a Saturday morning and I'm feeling like, hey, I want to go to Ipoh and check out, you know, the cafe scene there, that is on a whim, right? But hey, let me see what else is going on there. You've got to be able to open up hate it or love it, you've got to open up an app or some kind of service to be able to see what's available, because that's how people are, that's the user behavior today, right? So how important has technology been in, I guess, the way we're looking at travel and tourism today? Yeah, as we start wrapping up?
I think it's a mixed picture, honestly, Roshan. Mm. I mean, you know, there's a lot of talk at the moment about AI-generated tools, which make trip planning so much easier. And you think, well, does it really? I mean, it's just going to be a bit faster, perhaps.
Yeah.
But you're right. In terms of app, we live in an app world. So everything we do now is based on our phones and our apps. And when we travel, you know, our maps and, you know, how we navigate places, how we go and what we're looking for, what we see, the cafes around us, this kind of thing. We use those. That's how we travel. Is that new? Not really, because that was happening before the pandemic. It's just become more entrenched. So technology is really, really important into the way we travel. But is it actually decisive in terms of the future of travel? I'm suspicious of
that. I can't imagine asking ChatGPT to come up with an itinerary for me and it's just letting it go ahead and book it and pay for everything without me going.
You're placing a lot of trust on the technology and the data.
Yeah. And if something goes wrong, who can I blame for that, right? Hannah, anything you want to add to that?
I think just in, like I said before, I think it's this challenge of educating the SMEs how to be able to use these tools, because travelers we know are looking at these apps, but if the SMEs are not catching up, then they're going to struggle to capture that business. Even if they've got the best tour in the world, if it's not online, people are not going to look for it.
Yeah, sometimes if you're not online, you don't exist, right?
Yeah.
Maybe if you already have an existing set of clients, that's fine, but where are your new clients going to come from, right? And younger people, and let's not talk about Gen Zs for now, but the millennials who are in their 30s and 40s now, they're app-based, they're app-focused, and now they have hopefully have some disposable income at this point. So you want to be where they are, and a lot of it is on app basis. It's market, it's platforms that aggregate a lot of this.
But going back to your original point, I mean, does app-based travel enable us to be more whim-based in the way we travel? I think we would all love to think that we travel on a whim, but we don't. We do plan our travels. Everybody does, for a number of reasons, not just money, but time and family and kids and all that kind of thing. There are a lot of considerations that go into that. So I think the apps help, but they don't drive whim-based travel.
I guess it's just accessibility, right? Accessibility and the ability to do it faster.
Yeah,
perhaps.
Life is very structured, as you said.
Yeah, no, I don't see me going on a whim, unless it's, again, like I said, like, oh, let's go to, you know, it's a 2-3 hour drive. You know, I'm feeling I've got the whole day open. Let's go to Ipoh to have chak kway teow, you know, something like that. Yeah. But I don't see like, oh, let's go to Phuket today. Yeah. You know, I don't see that happening.
I mean, you're not going to see Hamilton tonight, are you?
No.
You're planning ahead to do that.
Planned it 6 months ahead. But yeah, so as we come to the close, I just want to ask for any closing thoughts on everything we've talked about so far, you know, of these trends. On a whim seems to be the weakest one at this point. But, you know, what are you both excited about for travel and tourism this year? Where can Malaysia shine, perhaps, or not shine? As we come to a close, Hannah.
I think one of the things that I'm definitely seeing more, and I think Malaysia should look at more, is this idea of soft power and really utilizing cultural tourism and Malaysia's strengths. I mean, this is something that Thailand has been talking about for ages. They've even got their 5 Fs, film, food, festival, fashion, and fight. And so they focus on that. And Malaysia has plenty of those in abundance. I just
have
to
branded
harness it. Yeah, exactly.
I mean, you've got 5 Fs right there, right?
Exactly.
It's like it is something that you can package and sell.
Mm-hmm.
And okay, these 5 Fs are the way that we're going to sell Thailand to the world. And it becomes a North Star, ability to kind of plan around that. And I think based on our individual conversations, I think both of you have been on the show with Nigel Wong of Mata. And the key, I think one of the things we talked about was just the lack of cohesive branding for what Malaysia stands for as a travel and tourism destination, which I think is still akan datang. So we'll wait and see how that plays out. Anything else to add to that, Hannah, before I pass the mic over to Gary?
I think you pass over to Gary.
And I think, as Hannah said, just how fluid travel and tourism is, particularly in the social media age. You know, we can't be too rigid in terms of focusing travel and tourism around, you know, history, culture, food, that kind of thing, because younger people want certain elements of things and they mix and match. You know, they're very experimental now in their emotional way of traveling. And I think we have to understand the social media generation a lot more, because trends come and go very, very quickly. They're not really interested in just certain aspects of a country. They want to dig a little bit deeper than that. And I think that's where some of the countries, Thailand is particularly adept at, Singapore too, is unraveling themselves a little bit in their tourism promotion, showing the hidden gems, showing how you can actually explore a country a little bit more deeply, because that's what younger people want to do now.
And I'm sure that's going to be a future conversation, right? How to get Gen Zs to visit your country. Hannah, Gary, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you both for your time.
Thank you.
Thanks, Roshan.
Folks, I've been speaking with Hannah Pearson. She's the founder of Pear Anderson, as well as Gary Bauman, director of Check in Asia. And we were talking about four key trends that could drive tourism in Southeast Asia. If you missed any part of this conversation, you can catch the podcast on the BFM app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can just look up Enterprise Explores. So keep it here to BFM 89.9, the business station.
You have been listening to a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station. For more stories of the same kind, download the BFM app.